Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Please subscribe, rate, review, turn on your notifications, and share your favorite episode wherever you found this episode. Thank you. I just want to state that folks need to write down our information because we are now, what is it, two strikes? One strike?
Yeah, we our second community strike. Second, we got a warning and now our first strike because we weren't allowed to talk about vaccines last week, so YouTube shut it down. You can see it on another channel, which we'll put in the link, that vaccine episodes. Apparently, they don't want us to talk about these things as if these are gene therapy technologies.
Let's not say that, Andy. Let's not say anything. All right. So, check us out at our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. Check us out on our 8 platforms, and specifically for video. You'll check us at Odyssey or Library. Right. So today we'll be discussing the anti-Asian sentiment, racism, the conversation around what has been headlining the news around attacks on Asian people. I think, Kenny, you wanted to start it off or something.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm that asshole that when I'm showing a trick, I want to see what's behind it, how it works, what's the purpose. So whenever I hear a fixation of the media on some topic, I like to look at what's behind it and what the motives are. And so, I mean, obviously, the incidents that happen, the violence against these Asian sex workers that triggered a lot of emotion response. And obviously, it's a sad event, but again, when I hear the media fixating on something, I feel like it's manipulating the attention of people for some some goal, some end. So I wasn't convinced that the full story was just that. It seems now that we're kind of moving on to another focus of the news cycle. And so, so through that, I dove into some of the history of violence against, Asian women specifically, or things that have been done in the name of protecting Asian women. And so, and obviously this comes in the context of essentially a cold war with China. And what we've talked about in this show that we foresee, a clash with China, and it's currently playing out on over, artificial intelligence and biotechnology. Those are my first thoughts, and that's why I started looking more into the history of violence against Asian women.
Well, most of this attention has been on what has happened in Atlanta because of last week on Tuesday night. There was a 21-year-old man named Robert Aaron Long, and who went on a deadly, deadly rampage. No, mm-hmm. On sex workers. Most people were Asian, and killing a total of 8 people. 6 of them were Asian women. And there were, I think, some of the most appalling responses to it from one of the officials. I think it was the county sheriff who had said that that the Robert Aaron Long had I think it was a frame something around him, like he had a bad day. I think my first reaction, my thoughts on it, is that I think it's important to denounce all racism, it's important to denounce all forms of violence that happens against anybody, really, and call it for what it is. I just feel as if this anti-Asian sentiment has been around for some time. It's not something that was born or initiated last week. So I think it's important that people who like to jump on bandwagons don't almost fetishize or want to use this as a way to move politically in a way that sounds very supportive of anything that's anti-racist or supportive or want to be allies of people of color. I think for the longest time we have to call out that any mode or form of supporting a system that is inherently racist, such as this capitalist system, is what we have to call out. We have to be calling out consistently and always be calling out this system that upholds those divisions. This is why the capitalist class uses a lot of racism, classism, sexism, all kinds of isms in order for us as workers to be divided. So sometimes I get frustrated when we are having these conversations, when the conversation on what's really holding on to this is not actually being talked about. And that's what I think we should be focusing on. And I had this conversation with some of my loved ones, and we were talking to my family. I said, you know, we're just not having the conversations about how racism is prevalent in all societies, and it's prevalent in our culture, and it's prevalent because it's a way to have us divided and pit us against each other. The perfect example of this right now is what we are seeing here in San Francisco politics, with what happens with one of the school board member, SFUSD board member, where she is of, I think her father is Black, but she identifies as Black, and she is a Black woman. And now we can see how it's almost as if oppression Olympics are being played out, or any form of there's a people of color being pit against other people of color. And I think that if we're not careful, identity politics actually is what causes this and causes to be divided, because we're not really seeing that we are one whole working class trying to work for the greater cause of us being liberated by this system. So I want to denounce any racist violence. Of course, Asians and Latinos and Blacks should be, and everyone should be part of the conversation. And we should call out racism for what it is. But it isn't something that has, again, like I said, it isn't something that happened last week. Something that wasn't initiated just from last week. It's been ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, racism is a way of scapegoating, right? Like, I mean, it's more than that. It's got an institutional role within capitalism, but it's a way when workers look at immigrants as the enemy, or if they look at a fellow Asian person as an enemy, that worker is falling for a scapegoat idea, that their problem is this other person who looks different than them, or comes from a different country. And in this case, this individual who did this, and I do believe racism plays into it, the act, right? I do believe violence against women and sexism plays into it, and racism against Asian people that's fomented in this country and has a long history in this country plays a role. There's a historic role of that, and then there's a long history of our racism against Asians in this country, and then there's a very immediate one. And the very immediate one to me is the U.S. capitalist class, whether it be Trump or Biden, is pushing an aggressive a relationship and an aggressive kind of war, kind of cold war with China. Tony Blinken met in Anchorage just this week, and there were big words put forward between the United States and China, U.S. trying to tell China, you know, we're the ones who run the show, essentially, and you know, we have a whole host of nations who believe that you are not acting right, and China basically saying, you're not going to tell us what to do. And Blinken, in a speech earlier, identified China as America's central adversary, declaring China to be the only country with the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to challenge the United States. And a major FBI director in Boston, who had been looking into Chinese espionage of people who were trying to steal U.S. secrets, said, no country poses a greater, more severe, or long-term threat to our national security and economic prosperity than China. China's communist government goal, simply put, is to replace the U.S. as the world superpower, and they are breaking the law to get there. So these, it's this sort of stuff, it's this environment, along, you know, I think, also with the blame for all the anger around the coronavirus that is now, you know, led to this anger against Asians that's coming out in this guy. And now this guy, and I do think white supremacists, you know, right-wing, alt-right, QAnon, you know, insurrectionists are once again going to be seen as those are the depository for this anti-Asian racism when it was whipped up by the very, these elites, you know, and the capitalist class. And I do think they're going to use this to strengthen their hand, both to continue to build the internal security apparatus targeting, you know, this guy who did violence today is going to be used as an excuse for our state to crack down even harder. And it's going to essentially allow a pass for all the stuff that is, has been said and is going to continue to be said by the capitalist class as it whips up more anger and more fear and more fear about China. And attempts to blame, in a sense, China for all the problems of the economy when a lot of those are, as it relates to coronavirus, right? When the U.S. response to the coronavirus was like, they used it to collapse the economy. They used it as a means of wiping out jobs and wiping out the middle class. And they didn't have to do it. They did it. And now they get to cover all that anger that has been grown out of that. They can put put towards the Chinese, or they put onto these lockdown oppositionists, the far right. Well, now they get to blame them and crack down on them further. So this is just, to me, this is where it gets back to Kenny's point, where the racism against Asians has been building for quite some time. I had talked to a woman I work with, actually, she's co-teaching in my class. She's Asian, and she's been like, well, there's been a lot of stuff going on in Oakland for several years now. And she goes, well, she was kind of wondering why suddenly now it's being talked about. And I do think this is an attempt for the U.S. ruling class to wipe its hands clean now and say, oh, it's them. It's never been us. And it's always been them. It's always been the U.S. ruling class, and never more so than today has the responsibility for this violence been on the U.S. rulers, and particularly Blinken and Trump and Biden and the U.S. ruling class today. And of course, they're also going to use this, like the Colorado shooter, to push efforts of gun control. And again, to exercise more control over the population as well.
So, yeah, you know, Eduardo, you made the point that, you know, this is not something new. This has been brewing for a while. And I took it upon myself to look a little back on history. And I'll be honest, I didn't know a lot of it myself. I didn't contextualize it until today. So, I mean, like any other subject that we discuss here, you know, I encourage people to do their own research, do their own, you know, investigation. I did a little bit of my own research, and what I found out was that basically the attack, or doing things in the name of protecting Asian women, is not a new thing. It actually goes back to the building of the first transcontinental railroad, which happened during the Civil War. So during the Civil War, a lot of the men were engaging in war. And so the U.S. basically empire needed cheap labor. So they brought a lot of Chinese workers to the U.S. And so, again, the Civil War happened between 1861 and 1865. The first transcontinental railroad started to be built in 1863, so during the Civil War. And then it was finished by 1869. In 1870, the U.S. passed the first Naturalization Act, basically affording African Americans citizenship, but excluding any other immigrants, meaning mainly Chinese men who had come to this country to build these roads with cheap labor. And so it prevented them from owning land, essentially. Setting an economic foothold in this country. And so within that context, it turns out that there weren't a lot of Chinese women really here. It was mostly men because they needed male labor. However, there were some women, and they were depicted as prostitutes and as sex labor, even though there was plenty of sex labor at the time from other ethnicities. And so that narrative was weaponized to use against Chinese men to make them look as sexual deviants who oppress women. And so in that context, in 1875, the U.S. passed the Page Act, which basically, in the name of protecting the oppressed Chinese sexual workers, they basically created what is now the precursor to the modern passport. So Asian women were first photographed and interviewed, and their biometric data entered into this little piece of paper, interviewed at the ports and stuff. And so, again, this was done to protect Asian women, when in reality it was an exclusionary act. Then after that, you start to see a migration of Japanese people into the U.S., and then you start seeing, the response of basically white workers in the ruling class whipping that anxiety, against the competition of foreign labor. And so you start seeing laws and policies that also target the Japanese, who at the time were starting to become, the Japanese nation was starting to, empire was starting to build up, become more powerful in started to be seen as a threat by the U.S. And then that leads us to, the exclusionary acts that ended in, concentration camps for the Japanese. And so that's just like some historical context that kind of demonstrates to me that, this is not new. The bodies of women in the defense of their suppression, the U.S. has whipped up the fear and the good nature of the population to pass things that are actually an attack on those immigrant populations. And of course, after that, we go into the imperial wars in the U.S. Presence in the Pacific, in Korea, in the Philippines. Another thing that I found very interesting was that how we all know about comfort women in the Japanese men, right? But what doesn't really get discussed is that the U.S. themselves took over the institutions of prostitution in order to wage their wars in Korea. About 15% of the South Korean women were used as prostitutes to comfort American soldiers at the time. Mm-hmm. And so we can also talk about Vietnam and Thailand and the sex tourism. So this obviously has created a hyper sexualization of Asian women, and in seen as an oppressed, weak sector of humanity. And so those are just some relevant things that I think that kind of contextualize for me, that in the name of protecting a certain sector, we actually, this nation has used that as an attack on a certain group.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff you're talking about, Kenny, I don't know a lot about, but it does sound right to me that the U.S. ruling class, not only will it create the situation that immiserates the people, but then in the name of then defending the very people it immiserates, it's going to create further mechanisms of control, not just of those people, but the other people, you know? And this is why the U.S. ruling, like, that's why it matters. Like, I know people are probably saying, oh, here comes Andy again. This guy in Atlanta, Georgia is doing this, and he's blaming Biden. He's blaming Trump. He's blaming the U.S. ruling class. But those are the authors of this violence. Those are the people who set this stuff in motion, in all sorts of ways, as well as, you know, they've done with the economy in the name of coronavirus that is then blamed on the Chinese. Well, you know, that they are the authors of it, and they use that misery to then further exercise control. And again, we've had many discussions about COVID and how that's being used right now, but this is another example. And I looked into the stuff around Japanese internment, which you had kind of mentioned. And I mean, what are we talking about?
Can I quickly ask if Kenny, were you making and also a reference to the Chinese Exclusion Act, right?
Yes, I forgot the date for that one, but yeah, there, you know,
1880 something.
Yeah, that, and again, there is a linear, you know, a sequence that you can see of, you know, we need labor, we don't need it anymore, we need to get it out of here, and they use women to weaponize the narratives, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Should I carry on? Okay. Well, the first thing to say is that there were concentration camps in the United States during World War II. We know it; like it's not a hidden history. This is 120,000 Japanese, 80,000 of them citizens, were taken out of their homes in the course of about 2 weeks and put into various camps that were barbed wire. I think they were, the thing that was said is that they were up to the standards held by the Geneva Convention for camps where you hold military, you know, prisoners. But essentially, you're talking about an entire section of U.S. population imprisoned during that time. And it's important to remember a few things. First, that was done by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, right? That's a Democrat. Like, it wasn't done by some far right. You know, we have to understand, this is the liberal darling Democrat who's responsible for concentration camps being built in this country. The other thing to know is it didn't start in the concentration camps were built after the Pearl Harbor attack, but it didn't start there. It actually started, the actual beginning of looking at identifying the Japanese started in the 30s. And that was initiated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the Office of Naval Intelligence, where they tried to start to create a special list of all the Japanese who were considered possible enemies and possible people who should be put in camps, right? They were creating a list in the 30s, a decade before this, about possible people who could be up for espionage. And the thing also to know about the internment camps is the government knew that these people were not dangerous. They'd had something called the Munson Report, which basically says, after working with the FBI and ONI is the Office of Naval Intelligence, and interviewing Japanese Americans and those familiar with them, the Munson determined that the Japanese problem was non-existent. This final report to the president, submitted November 7th, 1941, certified a remarkable, even extraordinary degree of loyalty among the general suspect ethnic groups, right? This was another one that I thought was interesting. The Munson Report, compiled by businessman turned spy Curtis B. Munson, which was the report used to justify the internment because these people were supposedly were so dangerous and were, you know, potential threats to the country. And that, like, that was what they were saying out loud, whipping that fear up. But internally, they knew it wasn't true. Munson, along with military intelligence and FBI, concluded that although the majority of Japanese in the U.S. were loyal, they still needed to do something, right? And Commander Kenneth D. Ringel, who contributed heavily to the Munson Report, concluded, after careful investigations on both the West Coast and Hawaii, there was never a shred of evidence found of sabotage, subversive acts, spying, or fifth column activity. But this is how the report spun it. It said this way: the very fact that no sabotage has taken place to date is disturbing and confirming indication that such an action will be taken. And they said, there are still Japanese in the United States who will tie dynamite around their waist and make a human bomb out of themselves. Have you heard that language before? So what's amazing to me is how clear it was to the US ruling class at that time that there was absolutely no threat by the Japanese internally, and yet they felt the need to intern 120,000 people. And that's not out of cruelty. It's out of knowing that they must whip up the American people into a frenzy over the war aims that they had, both the war aims in Japan that was going to lead to them dropping two nuclear bombs, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also their war aims in Germany, right? The so-called Great War where we're fighting fascism. A country which is interning its own population is talking about fighting fascism. It was never about fighting fascism. That whole war was about global control, and the way the US was able to whip up its own population to justify its imperial aggression, which is what World War II was about, was they did it on the backs of the Japanese. Japanese who had no threat internally whatsoever. The US ruling class knew they were no threat, had evidence of them being no threat, but knew they must talk about these people as an existential threat in order to justify the war aims and push those war aims abroad, both for US exercising power in the Pacific, and of course the invasion that would go on for Normandy and to race the Soviets to Berlin in an effort to make sure they could control Europe after World War II is fought. So that is what's going on today. All this stuff about Chinese espionage, all this stuff about the Chinese, there is a competition, but we should not believe for a second that that stuff is true in terms of things that we have to be concerned about. We have to understand that this is all an exercise in power and in control, and they're gonna use racism and nationalism again to whip it up. And one last thing I'll say. I talked to the student teacher I'm working with and said, do you think, because she's Chinese, I said, do you think this could end in an internment? Like what's happening here with China? And she says, it's bad, but I don't think it's going to end that way. And she also doesn't quite think it's going to lead to war with China. And here's what Justice Scalia said when asked about the internment that happened to the Japanese. And he was talking about this internment in 2014 before he died. And he was asked, you know, Justice Scalia, do you think it could happen again? And he said, you have to be kidding yourself if you think the same thing will not happen again. So Justice Scalia at the time knows that this thing's going to happen again. And he knows the stakes for the United States. And I do believe we've already interned Muslims doing things. I do believe we're looking at a future that's being laid out for us where the internment of Chinese in our own country is definitely up for a possibility as the U.S. continues to build for war.
I mean, I just want to maybe add and remind people that, you know, the U.S. dropped two bombs, atomic bombs, on Japan. Again, when they were surrendering, you know, when they were not the threat that they claimed it was, but it was the excuse to, again, to become the supreme power in the world and to show how vicious, you know, we were willing to be in order to be the hegemon of the world. And that hasn't ended, you know, that approach of showing, you know, viciousness. In 2017, in 2017, the U.S. dropped the biggest non-nuclear bomb in Afghanistan. You know, and like, this is nowhere, you know, this is the biggest non-nuclear bomb in people that we've also dehumanized. So, you know, we've seen this happen with the you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, where, you know, these people in North Korea too, these people are depicted as having an irrational fear and an irrational, you know, sense of violence, you know, as if you know, they didn't bomb your house and kill your family, you wouldn't be pissed, you know. But they are savages, you know. ISIS, the whole narrative, I remember growing up, in how they were depicted as being a category above, you know, in savagery. And so racism is very much part of our daily dose of news, you know, how we depict other nations as irrational and ignorant and backwards, while we are the most vicious, you know, or this nation is the ruling class of this nation is the most vicious, brutal ruling class that's ever existed.
My take on what I have to share, there was a lot of blame on Trump for stoking racism against Asians. And it was valid. I think they were valid. But what I had learned on history, especially local history here in San Francisco, is that racism against Asians didn't start with Trump. It didn't. Trump isn't what created the racism against Asians with what, especially last year with COVID, blaming China and blaming Chinese people during a global pandemic or an epidemic isn't unoriginal. It's something that happens in previous times as well. It's here in San Francisco, where progressive liberal San Francisco, where if we just take a look at the history of San Francisco, you would find how appalling a lot of the things that were done here during the early 1900s, when there was the bubonic plague, which is what caused lymph nodes on certain parts of your body and under your armpits or in your groin area. And it was a disease carried by mostly rats, although there are some reports of squirrels and other rodents that can carry it, but through fleas and unhygienic living conditions. And so here in San Francisco, before the plague hit here, it was around 1340s, right? It happened mostly the plague, La Peste, in Europe, and then it spread afterwards in Asia, contained somewhat, like when it waves, and then late 1800s spread throughout China, and then the first case, what happened in the 1900s in the USA. In Honolulu, and it was in that island that there was a Chinatown that was where Asian immigrants had lived in, because landlords would have cheap, unkept living spaces for Asian immigrants from many parts, especially China and of Asia. And this is where some of the practices that were done in San Francisco were imitated from what happened in Honolulu, such as burning places of living spaces where someone had died of the plague. And there was a fire in Honolulu for 18 days, I read, of a fire that continued in Honolulu because of the plague. And once the plague finally was discovered that it began spreading in San Francisco, it was there that it was very racially motivated. The reasons why there were certain people that were kept in quarantine and others that were not. So Chinatown here, everyone was, all of the Asians, Japanese and Chinese mostly, were quartered in, and they were not allowed to leave Chinatown. But if you were white, you could go in and out if you wanted to, and really victimizing and harming these minorities. At that time in the 1900s, there was a 16% population of Chinese immigrants. And this is after the 1880s Chinese Exclusion Act, which grew out of also a growing resentment against Chinese workers for taking away jobs or taking away most of those sectors of work that working class families were working in. And there was this anti-Chinese sentiment. There was this anti-Asian sentiment. There was a lot of racism, and there was blame on the Asian Asians population. There, and looking back now, it's horrible. The things now that you would never, you would think that, you know, the things that Trump has said and stuff, we forget that history has showed us that this is something that has continued to happen for a very long time. The way that they were treated, the way that they were even harmed, and the neighborhood, the quarters that were also here in San Francisco were burned, and they didn't let them out even when it was burning. I just wanted to bring it up as an example of something that has happened already. And this is blaming Chinese culture and bio threats from China and all this rhetoric that we see today. It mimics very much what we have seen in the past, the anti-Asian rhetoric. And I think it's important not to forget.
I just find it peculiar as to how historically Western rational, quote-unquote, scientific thought has been weaponized against people. You talked about the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was in 1882. But around that time, prior to that act being passed, the American Medical Association said this: Chinese women carry distinct germs that to which they are immune, but whites would die from. You know, and again, I feel that, you know, if we go back further, you know, the Enlightenment was used to excuse the slavery of black people and and scientifically prove that they were inferior. Mm-hmm. And somehow we think we're beyond that arrogance, you know, sometimes, you know, but at least from my perspective, it shows right now how that arrogance is being weaponized. It's not being directly, you know, targeted. You know, it is the way it moves. It has evolved. But the consensus, the arrogant consensus, you know, it is still a factor, you know, in creating this narrative, you know, in weaponizing narratives. I mean, we are not necessarily, you know, creating an act that excludes people, but we're closing borders. You know, we're closing borders from certain nations on the basis of, you know, COVID and all these things. So I just wanted to, you know, show my questions regarding Western scientific thought that is not, you know, we in the past we've talked about how the Big Bang theory is accepted as this fundamental truth, and there are questions around it. But yet, if you deviate from the main storyline, there is something wrong with you, and you're the unscientific person.
You know, the medical establishment has a very long history of being corrupt, and I always find it interesting how people trust the medical establishment. And I know that I have even fallen into some of it. In some of it, I do trust some of it. I've always been skeptical because of, I think I had an ex that always made me feel skeptical about the medical establishment. But, you know, around that time, they were doing a lot of forced inoculations of untested vaccines on specifically Asians. They were forcing these inoculations on Chinese people. And it was really what, you know, the what they were doing. They were just testing using people of color at that time as lab rats or guinea pigs. And we wonder why we should be, you know, all of this censorship and all of it. Like, shouldn't the medical establishment be questioned with its long history of the legacy that it holds, for all the things that it has done to other countries, to people in this country? And it's just a legacy that's been left behind. Shouldn't we always be skeptical? Question? Shouldn't we always wonder? Shouldn't we poke? How can this country claim to have a reputable reputation? You know,
Well, yeah, I mean, not just this country's reputation, but science. Like, I think, you know, people have been, during Trump time, everyone was like, science, you know, follow the science. Guess what? Follow the science means follow the capitalists. Because science under capitalism is capitalist science. And it is a weapon against people. It's a weapon of war, you know, between nations. But we can see today, like, you can look at AstraZeneca, and I think it's true of Pfizer, and I think it's true of Moderna, and I think it's true of the Chinese vaccine, I think it's true of the Israeli vaccine. Well, Pfizer is the one in Israel. These are all experiments being run on people. Now, it's not being forced on people, and here people are being herded into it using the fear of COVID to everyone line up for essentially a part of an experiment on essentially a gene therapy technique to see which country can get it to work. So everyone's being herded into it. The people who are being forced into it are the ones who are vaccine hesitant. Those are the ones who are going to get forced. And we can't force you right now under emergency use authorization. But as soon as we get FDA approval, we're going to force that onto you. And then once again, we come back to the passport. And the passport isn't going to be one that just says, can you cross national boundaries? The passport's going to be, can you go to your job? Can you go to your school? If you don't have a passport, you can't even go out of your house. Or we're going to tell you where you can go. So again, all these things, science is being used as a weapon to attack workers. Now, most workers don't see it that way. Most workers, and YouTube is going to shut this episode down for me saying that. But that is the reality, is that we have to understand that science, far from being neutral, is under a situation where we live under global capitalism. It is actually a weapon going to be largely used against us, and it's not going to liberate us. I even look back and think about our episode with Eric Lerner when he talked about plasma fusion, things like this. You know, at this point, bless his heart, I hope, but creating that thing under capitalism is not going to lead to anything other than continued misery for us. I mean, we will have to have a revolution. And I don't think that revolution is going to come from grabbing that technology and using it against them. I think that's just a different thing. But, you know, I think we have to have a very different view of science and the achievements that is allowed. What it is right now, it is just another weapon being used to shackle us at this point.
Well, for however long anyone is watching this and they've gotten to this point, please jot down our information. Andy, it's interesting you say that the FDA has not approved, but there is an FDA-issued emergency use authorization for third COVID-19 vaccine recently.
It's under emergency use authorization. And as long as it's under the PREP Act, you can't force it on, well, certain positions you can't force it on you legally, like state workers and things like that. But once it's on FDA approved, not under emergency use, then they can shove it down our throats or inject it into our body and force us to take it.
Just for also further clarification, the COVID tests, they're also under passed under the PREP Act. So they're not FDA approved. They are under emergency use authorization as well.
Mm. It looks like we should probably end here then. What's the point of continuing if it's going to come down?
But I do think there's more to carry on about.
Yeah.
Because I do believe this is in the media right now, not to help protect Asian women or Asians from racism. To me, this looks to be a story that's used, one, to deflect the actual guilty parties from doing it, who are responsible for this, and two, I do think it's going to lead to a crackdown internally on guns, and on it's further going to strengthen the FBI and its case around taking on white supremacists and things like that.
I mean, there is another element, I think, that is not talked about, you know, and some people might cancel me for thinking about, you know, white men and their mental health, you know, mental state. That I saw this statistic, I think it was done by Stanford, like a study, that since Reaganism, mass shootings have gone up. You know, and what coincides with that is 40 years of economic stagnation for, you know, the working class of this nation, you know, in the looting, you know, that has gone all the way up. Chris Hedges has a very good article. I think it's called Disease of Despair, where he talks about how white men are particularly seduced by the mythology of the American dream, American exceptionalism, and how, you know, the break in that dream creates, you know, certain desperation. And so obviously we, I think, especially from the liberal left goggles, and I think it's a huge issue that we limit acts of fascism, acts of racism to a single act, to a single event, when it's this whole system, the capitalist system, that is fascist and racist. And creates individuals, obviously, that do carry out incredible acts. And I think that's the problem with, you know, having this laser focus on this one horrible white man, you know, when in reality, we should hold the whole system accountable, you know, of why, you know, it empowers or it forces certain people to commit these acts, you know, like all these connecting, intersecting things. And, you know, that's why I'm a Marxist, you know. Because like I look at the whole array, and I don't just look at the leaves. I look at the branch, at the tree trunk, at the branches, at the ground, at the air. You know, everything that comes to form this moment in history. You know, and so again, I bring that up because, you know, the U.S. is a violent society, and you know it looks crazy from outside. You know, we've almost been normalized to accept, you know, the mass shootings, the all these. You know, but they're not detached from imperialism. They're not detached from, you know, the mass increase in the police state, in the militarization of our communities, and you know how the, you know, the technologies and techniques of imperialism make it back to the imperial land eventually, you know, and ultimately. At least this is one thing Chris Hedges argues, is that when empires collapse, you know, they collapse within themselves and they become violent against their own population, because no empire can go to war if their population is not under control. And so I think that's the biggest concern right now, that yes, there is a lot of violence in this nation, but we are living on in supreme moment of social control that allows our ruling class to go to war. That, you know, because I don't think I've ever, I mean, I don't, in the, at least in the little bit that I know of history, I've seen a degree of social control in, you know, maybe I guess during the world wars, or, you know, but it's a scary time, not because of the mass shooting, but because of the degree of control that is going to drive us to other words, in that, again, this is a feedback mechanism.
I guess maybe I would put one counter to that. One is that I think Chris Hedges thinks that the U.S. whipping up this violence is out of its weakness, and it's not. This is out of its strength. And the internment of Japanese during World War II was the precursor. That violence against its own population was the precursor to the greatest expansion of the US empire and to its collection of wealth over a 20 to 30 year period that is unmatched by any empire in its history. That is what the US is trying to repeat right now. And I actually do believe now the US recognizes it's got a challenger in China, and China believes that they're up for the task of taking on the US. That's what the meeting in Anchorage seems to show. When the US talked for 2 minutes and China gave US a 17 minute lecture back, right? That seemed fairly unprecedented. China was saying, we're not walking away from this one. We actually think you can't shut us down. And the US said, don't bet against us, all right? And they're saying that because they've already taken down other powers and expanded into their property before. So I don't agree with Chris Hedges' notion that we are on this kind of collapse thing. That's number one. Number two, it's not just white people who have this belief in the American dream. There are all sorts of immigrants who come over here who have a fervent belief in it and will hold on to it and will go back when they have to, when they've finally given up, you know, like it's not here. So that American dream exists for all sorts of, it's been sold to all sorts of people, black and white. So I don't know if my answer to what it is it's racism. It's like, it is whipped up and it's pushed into workers. The notion that Chinese workers are a threat to you was a lie. The threat to workers back then even were the robber barons. Those are the ones who had to be taken down. That's what Eugene Debs, the Chinese workers aren't your problem. You need to organize with them and take down the robber baron capitalists. So the notion that workers coming into the country are your enemy is a lie. It's factually untrue. It's actually true for the working class that they're your best friend, as long as you understand that the working class's job is to actually take power away from the one class of people who are your enemy, not immigrants, not women, not gay people, not Muslims, it is the capitalist class of any color, but the one in your own home nation that you have to deal with. Because my problem isn't the Chinese ruling class, that is the problem for the Chinese working class. So that's one thing I would say. And to me, the way I understand the anger right now is I think about the last year where under the notion of COVID, under the notion of a virus that has been talked about or originating in China and being spread by China, maybe even being a bioweapon from China, the U.S. ruling class locked us down. The U.S. ruling class is what mandated we had to wear a mask. The U.S. ruling class is what shut down all the schools. The U.S. ruling class is what eradicated the economy. They did all that, but they're going to put that on China. And that's what they're getting away with here. They're once again taking all that anger and saying, well, it maybe should be directed there. Oh, and look what happened. Someone's getting angry at those people. That's so bad. Look at that crazy rabid white right winger. We'll take their guns away from them. We'll actually keep you safer now in the same way that you're talking about, Kenny, that safety, which is actually further danger for everyone. So this is a massive trick being played. And I'm not saying, maybe you don't disagree with me on that, but there's a way that the way I'm hearing Hedges say it doesn't quite add up to me.
I agree on that. I don't think that the U.S. empire is going to collapse. We're in a collapsing stage. I feel we're in a gearing up stage, you know, and the only question I have at the moment is whether, and again, maybe it's a third example, but is it going to play out in a world war type of way, or is it going to play out in a Cold War type of way, you know, or is there a third way? And obviously, if it plays out in a world war type of way, I think that the technological ability of destruction, there is no winners out of this one, you know, because someone asked me, you know, they said, oh, the Chinese are going to come out on top. And I'm like, I don't think there is any winners on this one.
I had some thoughts around what you both were saying. And I don't think that when we're having conversations around race, a lot of people are having conversations about class. It's something that is just sort of, it's intersectional. As if that's just part of an element, but it isn't a high part of it. So the conversation around race keeps going in circles because it's all around race theory, privilege, identity politics, academia. It keeps going and going and going and going and going. And it festers, and there is all of this politics that people are being canceling out because of it, or people are not even able to, they're being even destroyed by their own politics. So I was talking about it with someone who works at USF, and I just find that there's just no way that you can do the objectives that the race conversations are trying to achieve, which is to eliminate, to get rid of, to eradicate racism, if you don't bring in class. Because if you don't bring in class, and if you don't bring in capitalism, which holds these divisions, as you were saying, Andy, with race is thrown into the working class to be able to divide, then we are not really standing up for people of color. We're not standing up for the ideals of anti-racism in a society that we wish to look forward to. Because there is class over there, race over here. And I was just saying that in the circles around anti-capitalism, socialism, anarchism, all of those conversations do talk about race. It's exactly the reason why we are talking about capitalism. It's because we want to dismantle capitalism to be able to have a society free of racism, sexism, and any sort of xenophobia. Those are the reasons why exactly these wave of people who are the anarchists and the social, all of the anti-capitalists are having. It's because of these isms that we want to get rid of, that we decided we're going to go really for the juggernaut. We're going to go really for the thing that is upholding all of this. No. And the conversations around race minimize and make it, it's just this little thing here of it's class, poverty, it's intersectional, but it's as well like gender is also part of that. And there's also all of these privileges. And so as you both were talking, I was just awakened inside me of how it is frustrating having conversations with my fellow ex-coworkers or compañeros or friends or people who I run into or bump into in liberal circles or progressive circles here in San Francisco, outside of San Francisco. There's just the conversation is missing talking about class as something that we need to tackle, and we need to unite around that. And I think that dismissing other people's experience because they're not of this race or because of that, or because you can't speak to this or that, we're losing a lot of, this is the reason why we're not being able to revolt and be together, to be able to dismantle the entire system. It's because there is a lot of divisions because.
I completely agree with you, Eduardo. And I think that was another reaction I had. I feel like, oh, they're throwing another like kind of dog into the fight, you know, like in training oppression Olympics, as who suffers more and this and that. I've seen that in my circles be corrosive, you know, in organizing. And like, I agree with you, there is a collective amnesia of, you know, the issues of class. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, our memory has been replaced with, you know, this liberal progressive stuff. You know, when we forget that, you know, in the 20th century, the liberation, anti-colonial, anti-imperialist movements were by and large Marxist. You know, Marxist in spirit. You know, and so we're gonna have to revisit that history. You know, and learn. You know, as to what happened there. Obviously, not every experiment worked out great, but you know, we're gonna have to re-understand and, you know, deconstruct this like liberal worldview of issues that puts, you know, I've been in a lot of community organizing spaces where capitalism is secondary or tertiary to the issue. It's not the central issue that holds, like you said, Eduardo, racism and, you know, all these oppressive institutions. And so we, and that's my mission, you know, to kind of democratize, you know, Marxism again, you know, like to take it out of academia and to put it in the hands of, you know, regular people. Because our generation, we're gonna need to dig deep, you know, and revisit those, you know, and understanding this worldview, this understanding of the interconnection of things. And sadly, you know, as in the case of any racial incident, the focus falls on an individual, not in the whole institution and system that holds all these oppressive systems, ultimately to exploit everyone.
I agree with you, Kenny. And definitely with the point you're making, Eduardo, I think it relates to some of our discussions we've had about the identity politics as not only not working, but actually inhibiting the chances of dealing with the issues that are animating the people who often hold those politics. One thing you said, Kenny, though, also, when I heard you say that those all those struggles from the last century were animated by with many of them with the spirit of Marxism. I actually think that's true, and that there was a class line running through those struggles. But then you said they didn't end well, like, you know, and but I think I want to put it sharply. All of them ended in failure. So all those struggles that were animated by some element of Marxism all ended in failure. That the people who were in those struggles, I believe, were animated by the same things those of us who are currently Marxists are animated by, with the aim of being involved in a struggle, and then in a struggle whose aim is to take down capitalism in their country and spreading it so globally capitalism is eradicated and the profit system is gotten rid of, and we have a democratic society of workers where human need, a society based on human need, can actually come into existence. That is the aim of those struggles. And all of them failed. Now, I know that for a fact because we live in this world right now. So that is also a challenge. And that is also a reason why people go, you're 0-70, 0-whatever, right? Like, I don't like your, I would say the Russian Revolution was a victory and then it went bad. So, you know, it's like, okay, you won, but then you lost. So I do think that weighs on things, is that record of failure causes people to be like, well, you keep trying that thing and it's not working. And that is a part of our history that we're going to have to reckon with as well. The actual record of failure in the sincere effort to engage in a struggle to transform society.
You know, and at the risk of playing the optimist here, I don't think it all was failure, in the sense that history was moved. We didn't reach the goal, but history was moved for a lot of people of the world. And yes, we still live in this oppressive system. The mechanisms have changed, and by virtue of its brutality, we live in this system. And so I still urge people to look back, and ultimately draw their own conclusions, because I do think history was moving. That's, dialectical materialism, you have to fucking clash and you have to push back. And that's what I'm pushing for us to learn how to swim back and push and move history forward and hopefully fight a better fight.
I agree with that.
I think those class struggles are what really were able to break down those barriers of racism and all of the other discriminatory practices, because it was in those struggles where, as much as one community or another community did not like each other, uniting and as one front, they had to let go of a lot of things that they didn't want to confront. You know, if you think about the Welsh miners in the community of Wales, where the LGBT community worked alongside the miners, very homophobic miners, and working together in Wales, they were able to tear down some of those isms, that homophobia, no? They were able to then release of that. And so I like the word that AJ had used once, chafing. It's in the chafing. Well, it's in the interaction. It's in the work together. Because people sometimes wonder, what do you do if we're not having those conversations around race? We will have those conversations around race. We will, of course we will. It's in the working together, organizing together, that, and if anyone says something racist, hey, what are you doing? You're working alongside your comrade here, right? So those conversations are had. But if we just focus on just race and we're just having conversations about race, we're not really organizing, then it's all just sticking into the theory, right? I don't think there's any progress there. People still go home after those classes or whatever.
There is this phrase that Vijay Prashad uses a lot. He's an Indian Marxist. And I listen to him a lot lately, but he quotes this line from, I think it's a document that was pushed on to a UN resolution, which is also problematic, but you know, the line that he uses a lot is the process of liberation is irresistible. The process of liberation is irresistible. So, you know, I don't know, you know, like for me, revolutionary politics and what we're doing is an act of faith. You know, it's an act of faith of trying to achieve something, you know, that obviously, like you said, Lipson, we're all in 70, but doing this in itself is an act of faith. You know, revolutionary, like we're fucking angry and we look at shit that's wrong. But I do also think that there is an optimism behind that, you know, that you expect better and that better can be achieved. Otherwise, like, you know, I ask you, Lipson, once, like, why do you do this? And you haven't given me an answer, but you told me my other option is to go play video games in a fucking room and just be sad. And so, you know, like, for me, this is an act of faith.
I still don't have a good answer.
All righty. Beginning to get tired here. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webno.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I remind folks, if you fancy anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, jot down our information, and subscribe to any of our 8 platforms for podcasts, Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, and for channels where you have a video format on channels BitChute, Libry, LBRY, or Library, LBRY, Odyssey, ODYSEE, or YouTube. If you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts Kenny Cepeda and Andy Lipson. See you next time.